So welcome everyone to our seminar on human rights, spiritual responsibilities, a crisis for democracy, I know there are probably some people here who've never attended one of our meetings before, so just by way of introduction, World Goodwill was founded in 1932 by Alice Bailey, and its purpose is to establish right human relations through the use of the power of goodwill. In our regular newsletters and other literature, we examine the various challenges which are facing humanity from a spiritual angle, seeking to identify the ways in which the many groups and individuals who are expressing goodwill throughout the world are helping to ground in human consciousness the vision of a world of unity, justice, and peace. And we regard this positive upliftment of consciousness as crucial, which is one of the reasons why we emphasize meditation as an important service technique. A little over 200 years ago, Thomas Paine produced a book entitled Rights of Man. In it, he argues that human rights are inherent in all human beings, and that government's sole purpose is the safeguarding of the rights of individuals. Of course, he was not the first thinker to talk in these terms. Others, such as John Locke, had preceded him. And the idea of human rights can be historically traced back at least as far as Cyrus the Great's declaration in 539 BC. Nevertheless, it was only by the time when Paine was writing that human rights was beginning to be accepted as a concept that applied not just to an elite, but to all people. Now, 200 years later, we live in a time where human rights are regarded as unexceptional and are seen as the most useful way to guarantee morality in the public sphere. So much so that even in countries where governments are oppressive, they still feel obliged to defend their human rights records. It is easy to underestimate what a huge advance this is. And much of the credit for this fact is surely due to the worldwide influence that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights has achieved in its 60 years of existence. Written in the aftermath of World War II, it was intended to give effect to the UN Charter's provisions on human rights. It has become a kind of gold standard against which national behaviour is measured. Given this widespread influence, we would be justified in asking what is the actual ultimate basis of rights. It would be possible to tie ourselves in philosophical knots, over the answer. But if we acknowledge a spiritual dimension to existence, the answer becomes simple. The origin of rights lies in the fact that every single sentient being is a manifestation of the one life, an expression of the divine purpose. As a result, every being is equally valuable in the deepest possible way. This is the basis for the claim voiced in Article 1 of the Universal Declaration that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. In other words, the notion that human rights are indeed universal. This may be the most controversial element of the Declaration. By claiming this fundamental identity of all human beings, it cuts across all differences of culture and religion. It may not be surprising that some cultures and religions actually disagree with this idea, and this is one factor we will explore a little bit later on. Human rights basically concern how governments should behave towards their citizens, which is why we can think and talk about the impact of human rights on democracy. Is democracy the best political system for guaranteeing human rights? Well, one would think so, given that democracy is the system most openly concerned with empowering the individual. And human rights are indeed all about the individual and what she can expect from the government. There is perhaps a tendency in mature democracies to rather take democracy for granted. But it would be wise not to forget the long history of struggle which has led us to this point. And there may also be a tendency to assume that we know what democracy means. Any takers? Now, the simplest definition, of course, is one person, one vote. And true, that's the core principle of democracy. And like human rights, it enshrines once more the fundamental equality of all persons and the value of the individual. But more is needed before a society would be classified as truly democratic. At a bare minimum, there must be a regular electoral cycle guaranteed by law. The ballot must be secret to prevent intimidation. The ballot must also be well designed and properly regulated to avoid fraud. The police and the armed forces must be non-partisan. And the media should be free to provide full and unbiased coverage of all involved in elections. This list is not exhaustive, and you can probably think of other conditions that are necessary. It is an interesting question whether any government yet existing would qualify, even in these terms, as a full democracy. By the same token, there is no society anywhere which implements the Universal Declaration in full. This is why the very existence of the Declaration is a kind of challenge to all governments, and in particular to democracies. It is because democracies already set the bar for their behaviour so high, especially with respect to individuals, that so much is expected of them. There is another factor that may explain why some democracies are regarded as more effective than others at implementing the Universal Declaration. Some thinkers make a distinction between civil and political rights on the one hand, and economic, social, and cultural rights on the other. Civil and political rights are those which governments protect simply by existing, for example, the right to life or the right to be recognised as a person before the law. On the other hand, economic, social, and cultural rights require governments to actually do something. So, for example, the right to social security or the right to education. Now, depending on the position in the political spectrum, some governments believe that it is the civil and political rights that should be the main focus of protection, while others believe that both categories must be fully protected. This debate explains why the Declaration, which contains both kinds of rights, was, when it was implemented into law, split into two covenants, one for each kind. And while most governments around the world have ratified both these documents, not all have. And furthermore, even many of the ratifying governments have included reservations in the ratification. In other words, opt-out clauses from specific articles. So it is clear that, for the moment, full implementation of the Declaration is a step that few democracies feel ready for. The factors already mentioned, although they introduce tensions between human rights and the idea of democratic government, are not really enough to justify the proposal that democracy may be in crisis. However, there are at least two other factors operating at the moment that have the potential to trigger such crisis. First, let's recall that democracy is government chosen freely by the people. The key question then becomes, who are the people in this increasingly globalised age? This highlights one of the areas where democratic societies are facing growing tensions. As immigration from different parts of the world increases, then societies are becoming more and more multicultural. And these different cultures must abide by the constitution of the country they now call home. The constitution of a nation, written or unwritten, embodies to some degree what it means to be a good citizen of that nation, and may include direct reference to the citizen's rights and responsibilities. However, no constitution can really capture the full implications of what it means to be a good citizen, for the simple reason that there are subtle, subjective dimensions to citizenship that differ from nation to nation. Tuning into these elements of the national psyche and conforming to these unwritten, unspoken sometimes customs is not something that can be done quickly or easily by the non-native. The non-native who has moved to another land is still resonating with the customs of their homeland. And besides, because these elements of thought and behaviour are so subjective, they cannot be reduced to set rules. This is probably why there is a degree of uneasiness in countries facing increasing immigration, as they cannot automatically transmit these values to newcomers, because they are so deeply ingrained in their own national character that they can scarcely define them themselves. And this also places a spotlight on human rights. If immigrants come from a country which takes a different view on the balance between the rights of the individual and their responsibilities to society, then they may have more trouble integrating into the society and accepting its version of democracy. Another factor facing governments that we can't ignore these days is that of international terrorism. Because of the perceived need to tighten security both at borders and internally, this can impact the rights that they guarantee to the citizens, particularly in the area of privacy. And this comes at a time when privacy itself is becoming an increasingly fraught area, given the abundance of information that states now hold about citizens. The growing number of ways that governments can gather information through monitoring internet usage, tapping phones, physically tracking people via CCTVs and mobile phone signals. And also, unfortunately, the blunders that governments have committed with this information, for example, losing millions of names on CDs and laptops. It may seem strange that two systems of thought that both enshrine the importance of the individual should be in such tension with one another. However, it has been pointed out by a distinguished body of elder statesmen, the Interaction Council, that along with human rights, we should also consider human responsibilities, and that both are needed to form a complete picture of human ethical behaviour. They make the interesting point that while the West is comfortable with a rights-based description of how individuals should relate to one another within society, in the East, there is often more emphasis on the notion of the responsibilities that the individual owes to others and to society at large. We could say that, while the West comes down firmly on the side of the freedom of the individual, in the East, there may be a tendency to come down the side of the smooth functioning of society. But are the two sides mutually contradictory? Or should we not be reaching for a higher synthesis, one that empowers both self and society? Maybe the time has come to recognise that, while it is indeed right and proper to insist on rights, both for ourselves and for others, we must also recognise reciprocal responsibilities to ensure the proper functioning of democracy, both within our own countries and in the wider world. So we should be thinking about helping our governments to make the right choices, not the easy ones, when it comes to legislating for the difficult times in which we live. And we should pay attention to events in other lands where democracy and human rights are, for one reason or another, under threat. If we truly believe in the spiritual basis for human rights and democracy, then we should be prepared to support them throughout the world. In other words, as Alice Bailey has proposed, We should act to support both the value of the individual and the fact of the one humanity. There are many things that citizens can do. On a national scale, there are parliamentarians who are focused on reforms who can be supported. And campaigns, such as Unlock Democracy, which incorporates the previous campaign, Charter 88. Keeping informed of the issues is obviously important. And one particularly interesting website is Open Democracy, which focuses on both reform efforts in the UK and democracy in the wider world. Supporting human rights on a world scale can be done by supporting the many civil society organisations who do sterling work in this area. Also, staying informed, particularly in the work of the UN in this field, is key. Supporting democracy in the wider world might be done through, for example, supporting election monitoring organisations. One such example is the Carter Centre, headed by ex-President Jimmy Carter. Finally, by meditating on human rights and democracy, we can subjectively empower these ideals and lend support to the frontline innovators and defenders in their daily work. All things are connected, and the power of thought is greater than we know. By giving the power of our concentrated thought, we help create the mental atmosphere in which breakthroughs and innovations in human rights and democracy can happen, leading to a world in which the value of the individual and the fact of the one humanity are universally accepted and respected. Thank you.
Thank you.